The next question that comes up to Jesus is from another group. This is the high priestly group, the Sadducees. And they're going to ask him a question about the resurrection, or really make a sling-off statement about it, actually. So what I need to do before we do it is look back with you on the Old Testament teaching in regard to the resurrection, the biblical teaching, and there are 3 points to make. The first is that in the tradition of the Bible, the Old Testament Bible, the long tradition had no concept of life after death. Just as in the Roman and Greek world, and it really all came from the East, their ideas too, the presumption was when you die, you're dead. And you're buried. That was the normal method of disposing of the body after death. And you're buried down in the ground, and then if you dig it up a little bit later, all you see is dust and bones. And so they developed the idea that somehow you existed. The shades, they call them, the shades of Hades or the shades of the netherworld, or when Aeneas goes down, or all of the ancient myths, when they went down into the underworld, all they met was you try and embrace your wife and you just go whoosh. And I presume mutually, if the wife ever wanted to embrace her husband again, she'd have the same problem. So you've got, they're just all wafty shades, ghosts. Sometimes they come out of the grave and haunt us. Well, we don't like that. But that's what they are like. That's the assumption. So let's read a couple of texts that indicate that. Psalm 88, 3 to 5, verses 3 to 5 reads, "My soul is full of trouble. My life draws near to Sheol." It's their name for Hades. "I'm counted among those who go down into the pit," the burial pit. "I'm like those who have no help, like those forsaken among the dead, like the slain that lie in their grave, like those whom you remember no more, for they are cut off from your hand." Psalm 115, verse 17, "The dead do not praise the Lord, nor do any that go down into silence." Isaiah chapter 38, verse 18. "Sheol cannot thank you. Death cannot praise you. Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. The living, they thank you, as I do this day. Fathers, make known to children your faithfulness." It's the king begging to stay alive, because what's the point? Once you're dead, God, I won't be able to praise you anymore. So look after me, get me well, and continue me in existing. That's why they wanted to live for a long life, because the end of life, that's it. I mean, unless you call that wafting around, haunting people at the dead of night, it's existence, but it's not life. However, there was more to it than that. In the scriptures, the Bible, they too had a kind of a longing, which we experience. Though they didn't expect to live after death, they still longed for something. "My heart is glad," says Psalm 16, verse 9. "My soul rejoices, my body also rests secure. For you don't give me up to Sheol, Hades. You don't let your faithful ones see the pit. You show me the path of life. In your presence there's fullness of joy. In your right hand are pleasures forevermore." Basically, that's just a longing to stay alive. That's what it basically is. But haunting it is also this longing to stay alive forevermore. Psalm 49, verse 15. "God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. He will receive me." Doesn't mean I'll die and then be raised up again. To be ransomed from the power of Sheol means to recover from a life-threatening disease. But in it is also some kind of a hint or intimation of immortality. Is that Wordsworth phrase? Something like that. Psalm 73, verse 23. I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterwards you receive me with honor. Whom have I in heaven but you? There's nothing on earth that I desire other than you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Now, it was also assumed that if you died young, that was a punishment of God for you because you'd done something terrible, or of your father because he'd done something terrible, or perhaps even your mother, who knows, or your grandfather. But somehow or other, early death was considered unnatural and a punishment. Mind you, that idea can still lurk around in people's minds now. Someone dies young and they say, why did God do this to me? Or why did God do it to my wife? Or why did God do it to my son? Not realizing that God didn't do it at all. But that's part of the psyche. It tends to think that God is running the world like a puppeteer, arranging everything, even our sins and the consequences of them and so on, rather than seeing God as the creative love, whatever the situations that arise in our life. But so they thought of that. But then something extraordinarily important happened to the psyche of the Jewish people. You've heard about the Maccabees, you've heard about the Maccabean revolt and so on, 168 BC. So only 200 years before Jesus' public ministry. Quite recent, in other words. There was the persecution of the Jews by the Syrians. And an awful persecution. They came into the temple, they emptied the temple out, they put a statue of Zeus on the altar, they murdered young men and old men and young women and raped and pillaged. You've heard of the mother of the Maccabees probably, the stories of the heroism of these young people and others who held to their faith and would rather be martyred than give up their faith in God. And that did something to the psyche of the people, it seems, that these young people dying, how could that be a punishment from God? They're heroic, they're sinless, they're martyrs. Like, they're wonderful people, but they're dying young. You got me? So it made them think, not because of an argument from the immortality of the soul, but argument from who God is. If God is faithful, how could God take life away from people who were giving their life out of love for him? So death mustn't be what it looks like. Death mustn't be death, meaning separation from life or God. It changed. It is a very important shift of understanding, a breakthrough of the psyche. And they started to believe then in the resurrection of the dead. They started to believe in not an eerie existence down in the pit, but somehow a full human existence beyond death, in a way that, of course, they couldn't imagine any more than we can. But because God is faithful, he would not take life away. Here's two texts, one from the book of Daniel, written at this time, Daniel chapter 12. At that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book of life. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. It's the beginning. In the very last book of the canonical Bible, Book of Daniel, the last book of the Hebrew Bible, it's the beginnings of the idea of the resurrection. And in the Book of Maccabees, which is in the Greek but not the Hebrew Bible, Jewish Bible, we read, our brothers, after enduring a brief suffering, have drunk in ever-flowing life under God's covenant. But you, by the judgment of God, will receive just punishment for your arrogance. And so, in that setting, by the time of Jesus, 200 years later after those books, the Pharisees, who were really, had developed from the Maccabee period, the Hasidim, they were the ones who wanted the law, who stood against Hellenization, or they wanted to be secure and complete in their religious practices. They believed in the resurrection. But the Sadducees, they're the high priests, the traditionalists, if you like, they rejected the idea of the resurrection as a new modern, if you like, Reformation idea, something that had come in later, but was not according to the real ancient teaching. So it's those Sadducees then who come to Jesus, they've got that mentality, anti-resurrection, anti-angel, anti-spirit world and so on. They come to Jesus. Some Sadducees came to Jesus saying that there is no resurrection. And they asked Jesus a question saying, "Teacher, Moses says," and they're quoting from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 25, verse 5, a very ancient practice in a patriarchal society, "If a man dies without a child, his brother shall marry the widow and raise up children for his brother." That was the obligation. Her opinion was not asked. That's what happened. Otherwise, his name would not go on. He's dead, and he's got no children to carry on his life. So his position has just come to an end, wafted into nothingness. So, no, that's important that the man's name continue, so his brother would take the widow, and hopefully they'd have a child, and that would be his child from the brother. Work it out as best you can, but that was the rule. So he says that's in the thing now. And they tell this stupid story to make fun of the idea. "There were seven brothers among us, and the first married and died childless, leaving the widow to the bread to his brother. The second did the same also, the third down to the seventh." She must have been quite a girl. "Last of all," you might say, thank God, "the woman herself died." Been through the family, so now she dies. "In the resurrection," they say, smart, "whose wife of the seven will she be? For all of them married her." And they're very smart. That's killed it. They've wiped the whole stupid idea. Look at Jesus' response. Jesus isn't a mamby-pamby debater. "You're wrong," he said, "because you know neither the scriptures," which they're supposed to be experts in, "nor the power of God." They've got the scriptures wrong. They're not in touch with their tradition, even though they say they are and are arguing from it. "And you know nothing about the power of God." He says, "In the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven." And don't get this wrong. He's not saying married people no longer have a relationship in heaven. He's saying you don't marry in heaven. I've done it. I've lost my chance. So you don't get to heaven and then look around for a wife so that you can have kids and start the whole, the bottles and the late nights and the nappies and the whole show going on again. He says, hold it. Because you're like the angels in heaven, meaning, in this sense, that you're immortal. The angels are those who don't die. They're immortal. They're not mortal. Death is not part of their organic processes. It is of ours. We have to go through death to find life. In fact, we're doing it every day. And emotionally and in growing up and psychology and childhood to adolescence, we're always dying. You give up as being single to marry and you get all that. So we're always dying and letting something go so that something beautiful emerges out of it. And finally, we've got to let go of this whole beautiful existence that we know so that the butterfly can come out of the chrysalis and leave the caterpillar behind. We've got just our process, but not the angel. So in heaven you are immortal. You just live forever. Life in its fullness is yours. So marriage and children to ensure a heritage later on is not part of the deal. He says it nicer than that, but that's what he says. "So, and as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God?" And he quotes one of the sacredest texts where God appears to Moses, which is in the Torah, which the Sadducees agreed to. I'm the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. That's what God says. He's the God, not of the dead, but of the living. What a fantastic end to that problem. You mums and dads would know this. You give life, you don't want to take it away. Sometimes you might in an odd moment. But you give life and you want life to go on. Well, if that's how you are, how we all are, what about God? He gives life. Now, we do have a very strange, mysterious life, a life of aging and letting go. But actually, it's a life where we mature too, because the soul grows through all the pain and the letting go and the anguish and the reality of our life. The soul is being formed, the psyche is being formed. And death, please God, will meet us all when we're ready and when we've matured to the fullness of who we've become. And that's who we are according to our love of God and love of others. Our love is what makes our resurrected body what it is, a resurrected person. So God is a God of the living, not the dead. And when the crowd heard it, they were astounded at his teaching. And we come to the last of the debate. When the Pharisees heard that he did silence the Sadducees, they gathered together. It's all the different groups, you see. And it's Jesus confronting them with where they're going wrong in their leadership of the people. The Pharisees heard that he'd silenced the Sadducees. They gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. Again, not to discuss, not to find an answer, to test him. Teacher, he said, which commandment in the law is the greatest? And Jesus said to him, quoting from the book of Deuteronomy, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. There's a lot in that we could unpack at another time, but it's very important, isn't it, to love God with all your heart, but don't forget the other two, with all your soul, that is all your longing, and with all your mind. We're not allowed to let our mind go in the name of religious conversion. Religion goes beyond the mind. The mind has extraordinary limits. But everything that comes within the ambit of the mind must be rational or it's wrong. Religion is not irrational, it's beyond reason. But if reason can show something to be wrong, reason must be followed. All the saints insist on that. I'm thinking of Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross most powerfully make that point. Because it's so easy for religion to be wafted off somewhere. And if it's not reasonable, it's not right. And I don't mean by that, as you know, that everything in it has to be able to be understood by the rational mind. Because a rational mind should know its limits. And a really rational mind is open to the mystery of life, love, light, darkness, the future, God. The really rational mind does not close off doors that it can't understand. But the argument in this little moment is, let our love for God be with all our mind too. And if something can be shown not to be in accordance with right thinking, don't let's make the terrible mistake of thinking it's religious and correct. This is the greatest and the first commandment, said Jesus, and the second is like it. Love your neighbour as yourself. On these two commandments depend or hang all the law and the prophets. It's quite lovely to see the which comes first, love of God. And that doesn't mean put God before your wife or husband or family. God isn't one among many. We're not talking about a lineup. I love you more than you, more than you, more than you. Love isn't like that, I don't think, is it? You love all your kids and you love them all differently, but you wouldn't have them in an order. And you don't put God first and then something else second, then something else third. God is all-encompassing, but surely we're being told that if we've got the wrong God and if we're not open to the mystery, then we're not really loving our wife or husband or family, or because we're not seeing the most beautiful thing about them, namely that they're held in existence by God. That's their most wonderful quality and their greatest freedom against our maternal or paternal oppression, because we can't interfere with that mystery once we know it's there. We must respect that mystery. So we'll love, but we won't dominate or control or hedge in or clone. If we're open to God, we'll accept those around us, husband, wife, child, as a mysterious gift of love from God. So the first is to have our heart, soul and mind open to the mystery we call God. But the second is very practical. Love the one around you the way you love yourself. I would have had I time, but I'm not sure I'm going to have time. So there's many texts in the New Testament bear that out about loving one's neighbour. Paul, John, James. But I'll take them as read because I think the point is often reflected on by all of us. But it's absolutely central to our Christian life. Let's move on. So this concludes this half the section, then I'll move on to the next bit. They've all been testing Jesus. Now he tests them. He asks them a very simple question. While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them this question. And this is the final question. What do you think of the Messiah? Whose son is he? And they said to him, the son of David. They've got it clear. The son of David. But Jesus said to them, how is it then that David by the Spirit calls him Lord, saying, the Lord, Yahweh, said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I put your enemies under your feet. If David calls the Messiah Lord, how can he be his son? No one was able to give him any answer. And from that day, no one dared to ask him any more questions. Their answer was correct from a more superficial point of view. Everyone knows the Messiah is the son of David. So if you relate the Messiah to David, you would say he's the son of David. But Jesus comes in at as he always does, at a totally other angle. And he relates the Messiah to God. So while, yes, he is the son of David, there's a far more profound dimension to the reality of the Messiah. He is the Son of God. He is the Lord. He is Yahweh among us. He is Emmanuel. He is God with us. In other words, he's asking the Pharisees, I presume the logic of this question is to try as a last resort to break through their theological constrictions that are blocking in their mind, their catechisms that are all too fixed. The system that's got them all channeled. But they're meant to sweep a lot of that aside and then leave, surely. So it's got its place, but it's like the scaffolding of a building. If you leave it there forever, the building will look terrible. It's meant to help you build it, but once it's built, you knock down the scaffolding and let the beautiful curves and light and glass and colour do something for us. So he's asking them to leave their narrower view and realize that the Messiah is really quite mysterious to them. something to do with Yahweh, something to do with Lord, something to do with the revelation of God's redeeming love, which is what Yahweh means. Somewhere in there. And if they could only do that, they might even find the Messiah in Jesus. That's what the Christian church was asking, and that's what Jesus is.